This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T. This is Adam Shartoff, coming from FilmWax World Headquarters. I saw a movie tonight which got me thinking about the movies I used to see when I was a kid. I was at the screening of this movie called The Kings of Summer, which is going to be at Rooftop Films this weekend. We'll probably mention that a little bit in more detail in one of the segments in this episode. I speak with Dan Uxel for a little bit about how the first couple of weekends of Rooftop Films 2013 has gone and what's coming up in the next week or two. And I was sitting there and I was watching this screening and I was thinking, you know, this, I wonder if my son would like to see this. He just turned 9 and I was thinking when I was 9 years old, well, this was way before, you know, Walt Disney's Renaissance and before Pixar and the whole revolution going back to The Lion King and all those films. Seems like every couple of weeks there's another film for kids. And even the Japanese anime films could fall under that category. There's just a lot of options. When I was a kid, we didn't think about that. You know, of course, you'd have a couple of films here and there, but they were more in the lines of Herbie the Love Bug, that kind of thing, the Shaggy Dog, and those types of live-action Disney films. They were fun. Don't get me wrong. I really enjoyed them. Dean Jones would be in them often, you know? Anyway, so I was sitting there and I was saying, you know, my kid could come, you know, because when I was his age, roughly, I was seeing, you know, these films that were really intended for adults. And, you know, I love them. They stay in my head. And I think the reason why so many filmmakers, well, because they decide to become filmmakers as a result of the same inspirations that I guess, took from those films. Which films? Well, of course, there were things, of course, like Steven Spielberg and James Bond and all those films. But there was also, even going a little bit further back, films by some serious filmmakers. I remember, and I bring this up occasionally, seeing films with my dad like Chinatown. Because I remember these films because he would put his, when a part would come up that was in too intense, he would tell me to close my eyes. My dad took me to see Charles Bronson in Death Wish. Now, that came out in 1974. I was like 10 years old, and my dad took me to see that. And in that film, Hope Lang plays his wife, and she and their daughter get raped. Do you remember that? I don't know if you've seen it. And he tells me to close my eyes during that scene. That was parental guidance, 1974. And he took me to see Chinatown. And when the scene came where Jack Nicholson's Jake Gittes, his nose was sliced, again, my dad said, close your eyes. Because I think he had already seen it. I could be wrong. I could be remembering things incorrectly. I also remember going to see, I don't know, was it Thunderball or one of those mid-70s James Bond films, and it was with my sister and a friend of hers or something like that, and we were in the Midway Theater in Queens, and there was a guy spanking the monkey right across the aisle. I didn't see it, but I do remember being the subject of great concern and conversation for weeks and months, and it became part of the family lore. Remember that time you guys went there and there was a guy masturbating in the theater to James Bond movies? Because, you know, Those Bond girls were sexy, you know. So, and there wasn't a lot of other options. There was no porn theater in the neighborhood. And then, of course, there was Radio City. And then my dad also was in the magazine business, and he got all the press screenings, which is kind of maybe had more of an influence than I realized, because we went to the premieres and opening nights of many famous films, a lot of bad ones too, but a lot of amazing films. I think those things really had a profound influence on me, obviously. And I think that's true for a lot of filmmakers. I think they, when they were younger and they saw these films, they really stuck in them and they kind of helped create the fabric of their personality. And I think it still happens in films these days, you know, if there just seem to be fewer and far in between. I could be wrong about that, and that's maybe the crusty old guy that's kind of creeping up on me Anyway, those are the kinds of things. I will say that The Kings of Summer was awfully good. Anyway, so this is just one example. Rooftop Films actually really has outdone themselves this season. I there are many really, really good films coming up this season, so don't wait too long. Get tickets. Anyway, that's just me plugging that series, because I think Dan and Mark and all the rest of them really had that same devotion to programming that I do to this show. You know, the love of cinema. So that leads me into this show. Two more filmmakers who maybe I was referring to on some level a moment ago, Andrew Siemens and Brian Wiseman. We did part one last week, and I'm going to play the rest of that talk. I think it's a great conversation. We get even more in depth about the challenges and difficulties and of course, the rewards of being a filmmaker in this conversation. And we also talk a little bit more about Nancy Please, which is Andrew's film, the one that's going to be premiering at Rerun Theater Friday, the 24th of May, coming right up. And then, as I mentioned, I have a conversation with Dan Nuxall about Rooftop Films. And in the next couple of weeks, I've got a bunch of things lined up. One other thing that came up today, which I'll play next week, is a conversation with Marina Zenovich. Marina directed a couple of documentaries about Roman Polanski. There's that name again. And just recently did a film about Richard Pryor called Omithologic. I saw it at Tribeca Film Festival, and it's going to be on Showtime at the end of the month. But if you don't have it, I'm going to be working with her and her folks to try to screen the film as part of my Docularius series up at the Maisel Cinema sometime really, really soon, so that those non-Showtime subscribers get a chance to see it too. It's so good. It's so good. And it's another really strong memory. I just went off to college in upstate at Bard, and I had my girlfriend, who was still in her senior year of high school. She broke up with me. Yeah. And so I left school, and I came down. The holidays were encroaching, and what a jerk. I came down, and I tried to, you know, like, convince her into not. And she, of course, knew better and broke it off. And I was really a mess. And my sister and I went to see Richard Pryor live at the Sunset Strip. I'm pretty sure it was that one. The one where he's wearing the red suit. I'm pretty sure, and I'll have to check my copy because I have a copy of it, that he goes off at one point and starts talking about heartbreak and just what it does to you. And man, that was a cathartic experience. I was able to laugh at it. And I remember it feeling just a little less in pain after that. That's the way I choose to remember that experience anyway. So when I saw Mythologic, it just brought back a lot of memories of that period of time. Thanks for letting me yammer on, as I will do. We're going to go right now into part two of Andrew Siemens and Brian Wiseman talking about filmmaking.
I despise you. I disliked you the first time I met you because your hair is stringy and you smell weird. But the more I got to know you, the more I came to understand that there is something willfully hostile about the way you interact with people, and that all the things that make you unattractive and grating are the result of deliberate choices, and that you make those choices because you are a worthless, despicable shit. You're stupid and obnoxious, and you're gonna die alone.
Brian, why don't you describe Andrew's film?
Yeah, sure. I should say that Andrew and I, in addition to writing together, will also pester each other to read early drafts of scripts. And I thought Nancy Please was fantastic right out of the gate. It was written with Will Heinrich, who is a novelist who had some real early success with, you know, sort of winning awards for first novel awards. I think he even shared one with Jonathan Safran Foer at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And he's an all-around fantastic guy. And I remember even Andrew coming to me with, even at the idea stage, saying, you know, I want to make this sort of small pressure about this guy who who, you know, loses a book, who can't find his book, and he thinks it's with his roommate, and they don't get along, and it just kind of, and the writer's block part of it, and it just overtakes him. And I thought that that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I think making the small writ large, you know, there's a great film called When the Cat's Away, the French film. Do you know about? It's just about this woman who loses her cat, and that's sort of the narrative thrust of the whole film.
Right.
And I think Andrew's sensibility when he's on his own, something I didn't sort of realize about you, but you veer toward kind of some of these genre conventions and horror conventions and thriller conventions in an interesting way, but never in an egregious or sort of overbearing way. They're kind of sneak in there, you know. I thought Eleanor is great in the film. I thought Will, the lead, is really fantastic.
That's Eleanor Hendricks and Will Rogers. Just want to give a shout out to my wonderful cast. Will Rogers plays the lead role of Paul, and he's fantastic. He's a primarily theater actor these days around town, and tremendous talent, all around great guy. Eleanor Hendricks, who plays the eponymous Nancy, you might know from Pleasure of Being Robbed, and Daddy Longlegs, and Mad Fever, and whatever.
Pleasure of Being Robbed.
Yeah,
Dish in the Spoon,
she's in all sorts of stuff, and she's great.
She was in Northeast, which she came on this show recently on this podcast.
That's right. She's a rising star,
a star in my eyes already. But yeah, you're right. And she casts too. She's cast quite.
Yes,
a few films,
yeah. She does a lot of different things. She's a real Renaissance woman.
For like,
yeah, she's also an amazing photographer.
Right,
still photographer. Pictures are really great.
So proud of her.
And also, one thing I was pleased to note, that Santino Fontana, who plays a supporting, a kind of major supporting role in the movie, just got nominated for a Tony today. He plays the prince in Cinderella on Broadway, and he's up for a Tony, which is
well done.
Congratulations, Santino,
and
if you're listening to this.
Santino, well done. Kudos.
That was just another movie, another French movie, like what you were mentioning about how a very, very small, seemingly inconsequential conflict or problem can snowball and become something that overtakes one's life, which is really what happens in Nancy Please. Another example is, have you seen that movie La Moustache, directed by Emmanuel Carrière? I love that movie. I love La Moustache. Did you see that?
I think I have seen that.
It's this great movie about just this thing, about, it was really kind of an inspiration for the movie. The story of La Moustache is, it's about a man who he shaves off his mustache and no one notices, and gradually he can't reconcile the fact that no one realizes he doesn't have a mustache with his experience, and he goes crazy. But he goes crazy in a particularly interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I like this idea of taking some kind of tiny, tiny little trivial matter and seeing how it balloons into something that completely overtakes someone's life and experience.
One of the things that I was surprised by from the critical support that Andrew got after premiering at Tribeca, that I didn't necessarily glean too much from the early drafts of the script, was how much it deals with writer's block, and a very specific kind of writer's block, which is sort of graduate dissertation writer's block. And some of the critics like latched onto this wholeheartedly, and they're like, this is the anxiety, and he found a way to sort of dramatize it and illustrate it in a way that is just tense and works and can get inside your head like a brain worm and just crush you. And you find outlets for those nerves and for the block and for the sort of, all this kind of evil resonates around you and you don't know where to put it. And this book and his notes, which are clearly inconsequential, or, you know, it becomes such a just an object of scorn and ridicule and obsession, that it seems like, especially professional writers and critics, and, you know, when they're faced with this all the time, completely loved seeing that, you know, in dramatic form.
Yeah, I guess that's advice to filmmakers anywhere. If you can make a film about something that critics particularly can identify with,
it's the way
you're going to get better reviews.
It's the way, like Sideways. Didn't A.O. Scott say about Sideways, the reason everybody loves Sideways is because they're all mid-40s drunk, you know, lost people watching the movie? those are the kinds of critics that are out there.
Yeah.
It was definitely, that's definitely a critic's favorite, that one, right? Every critic got on board that film, I think.
I think the Todd McCarthy in Variety said it had, paraphrasing, but it was something incredibly hyperbolic, like it single-handedly reinvents humanism in the American cinema. And I don't even know what that means, but he said something to that. He was, it was one of the most fawning reviews I've ever read in my life.
But apparently it did have an impact on Merlot sales, right? Like, at least in the United States, anyway.
Wasn't it Pinot Grigio? Wasn't it?
No, it would have been a red
wine. Oh, it affected Merlot sales because nobody wanted to buy it because he's like, I'm not drinking Merlot.
Right, Merlot would piss him off. And so people stopped drinking Merlot. And I think with the one he was, and he wouldn't drink Chardonnay either, I think. But right, so I think it was, unless I'm mistaken, might be.
It's been a long time since I saw that picture, so I can't remember the details.
Yeah.
But,
well, you can see it again at the 10th anniversary screening at the Film Wax Film Series. Not that I've booked it or anything.
Maybe we should move on to now that Brian and I have been saying nice things about each other, we could criticize each other's film. No, I think that's a terrible idea.
Yeah, me too.
I don't want to do that.
You're better at, you criticize your own films. You haven't had a chance to do that too much.
Oh, I don't think that would be a good idea to. Once you turn the tape recorder off here, I'd be happy to give you a full litany of criticisms.
Andrew's first feature aside, if you ignore the acting and the script and the plot
and the direction
and the direction and the visuals, it's a really lovely film.
Right.
Yeah.
But you focus on the intentions. Like, it's so well intended.
If you just get into the film he wanted to make rather than what's actually on the... No, Andrew, and this is how we work, is... we bitch and moan and ridicule, and great ideas are formed. No, we both respect each other's work a great deal.
I think you should call the film Adrian, Please or Alice, Please, though, because it's not going to be the top
in the
of
A.
The pile.
AAA Nancy, Please. That'll be it.
Yeah, I have nothing.
It's happening. It just happened to Ramon Barani's film. Didn't that get retitled to At Any Place? But wasn't it called something?
It's a very generic sounding title. Yeah. At Any Price. I couldn't remember it every time I bring it up. I even said it to the audience. What the hell's the name of this movie?
I think it was retitled. I have a feeling I read about it.
That was the other one. I was really looking forward to it. I was like, they've given me the Q&A with Ramon Barani, who, you know, Chop Shop, Vanquish Card, Goodbye Soul, all these films, which are, I love those films, you know? And so I said, great. Now I can do the Q&A with him and then, you know, smooth the way over for asking him also to come on to this thing. And no show at all.
Oh, wow.
The whole entire festival.
I'm a big fan of Barani's. I thought Goodbye Solo was really, a great achievement. Perhaps a bit overpraised, but a wonderful, simple human film.
Don't you think everything's overpraised? Everything?
Well, I have a feeling about this. Like,
I feel like people... There's so many bad movies. There's so many mediocre movies.
Yeah.
There's so many movies that don't work, that when you get something that really is good, even if it's not spectacular, even if it's not Citizen Kane or something, that people are so excited to praise something unreservedly that they kind of go gaga.
Well, I think, here's my two cents on that. I think it's very fun to write a scathing review, and I think it's very satisfying to write, like, you know, run, don't walk kind of review, like a glowing review. Right. I always think of Manola Dargis's review for Old Joy. Like, I've been a Will Oldham fan for a long time. When I was in my 20s, he let me use some rights to, I think, something off his first album, Come a Little Dog, just by sort of writing to Drag City and pestering them. And also a big fan of Kelly Reichert. Jeff Grace, our composer, had also composed Meek's Cutoff, and he was a pleasure to work with. But, you know, the Times review for Old Joy was like, this is the great American masterpiece, and just couldn't keep a lid on how lyrical and amazing and poetic and everything. And that film is a strong film, but it nowhere near matches the review. And these are all very smart people who are writing those reviews. So my sense is, I think people who write for the Times or write for large publications are at this point have gotten market savvy, and they're very savvy about the industry, and they know that a film like Old Joy is going to play for a week at Film Forum and disappear and evaporate. And a lot of the films, I mean, look at Richard Brody in the New Yorker. He has nothing bad to say about any film made for less than 50 grand. He's the champion of mumblecore and anything that it spawns. And I feel like, I think I've heard anecdotally that he feels like he has to support these films. And in a way, I mean, I know he likens them to sort of, a French New Wave, and that's really flattering, but there's some awful films out there that no one should be subjected to. And so I think something very sophisticated is going on with these critics, where they know these films are just not going to get a wide audience. And maybe if they're
voting agenda, then
they're what?
They're voting, or rather not voting. They're writing about, basically have an agenda, and they're supporting the agenda with each piece they write.
Yeah, so either consciously or subconsciously, something
like
that.
When I go to vote, I don't care who's running. I mean, doesn't matter. I mean, it could be a great candidate, it could be a lousy candidate, but I'm only going to vote my party because I have an agenda, which is I have to keep the other guys out of office, no matter what, no matter who it is.
I know, I always feel shitty if I go see a movie that, a very low-budget American indie, and I made one, and I see a lot of them, and I go to, and then I get into a conversation with your friends afterwards, you know, what did you think? I feel terrible criticizing them. I mean, even if I have valid criticisms, I feel like, you know, say you make a few negative comments, and you're like, oh, shit, I mean, they struggled so hard, and they've got a tremendous talent, and okay, that element didn't work, or maybe I didn't care for the movie, but then you just feel like a jerk laying into something that was so difficult to make and so heartfelt. And
I agree with you. It's definitely much more rewarding and much more supportive, which is clearly some. I remember calling Andrew from my set, you know, saying like, why would anybody consciously choose to make a movie, you know, especially this budget level? And it is so hard. And there are always, it's not that everything's good, but there's good in everything, you know, and it's so much more satisfying to find what they were trying to do. You know, like Amy Simons has a movie out right now. I love Kay. I love Kentucker. I think that it's Sun Don't Shine. And I think they did a fantastic job. I don't think it maybe is exactly what they wanted ultimately, but like given the budget, what they had, given the constraints, given just the chaos of independent film in general, it's a fantastic achievement. And she's
Richard
a great.
Brody loved that film.
Yeah, sure. I'm sure he did.
And it was a New York critic.
Didn't you
York
call it like Badlands Jr. or something like that at a party the other night? just to out you a little bit. No, but Amy is a fantastic actress in her own right, and it's great to see where people's sort of film lens or film universe lies, what they're interested in doing when they get behind the camera. And so there's a lot to be said for supporting the things that speak to you rather than meticulously tearing something down.
You look at me like I look like I had something to say?
You and I will privately do that. But
this is private.
I think we'll privately take down a film, and I don't think it's for any other reason than I'm as inspired watching a bad film as I am watching a good film, because shows you, one, how easy it is to do, and two, how you can learn. You're like, oh my God, they just can't stop cutting this fucking scene. Just let it run. Or you see sort of what, you know, learn from others' mistakes, because you'll never have time to make them all your own, you know.
I started it like writing criticism. I mean, and I never had a desire to write it. It was just my kind of way in, and I wrote 100 reviews or something. And but I tried to avoid any bad reviews. So what I did is I just opted out of, you know, if a film was something I didn't like, I didn't write about it. You know,
right, that's the sort of hammer to nail approach. I think they only write about things that they think are worthy. I don't know about you, but I think that I might speak for you as well a little bit too, Brian, is that when I was younger throughout my 20s, I developed this sort of overdeveloped critical capacity for movies, where I was just really hard on movies. I read a lot of criticism, and it got to the point where it was hard for me to enjoy movies because I was just picking them apart and really emphasizing the things that didn't work. And then you go make a movie, particularly a feature, at least in my experience, a feature. And it reminds you just how amazingly hard it is to do something really good. And now I feel like I go to the movies now I feel like I've sort of regressed to this more wide-eyed approach where I see things and I'm like, holy shit, how did they do that? That was great. I could never do that. And so that's been a sort of happy result of, yeah, of doing this and going through this experience is that, yeah, I mean, I still see the flaws, but I'm able to enjoy the things that seem to have magically come together.
You're so complex, Andrew. No, but it's kind of interesting because I see you as kind of a very dry, I wouldn't say cynical guy, but I would say you're very somewhat sardonic at times. And I just think it's really refreshing to hear you say that because I'm like, you know, I definitely go in every time. And I see a lot of films, and I go every time wanting to like the film. And more often than not, I like a movie more than most people. Even really flawed films, there's always and I rarely walk out. And I would if it really, I felt, was a really cynically made film or just really sold out to whatever reason, you know, or just was so wrong-headed. But that's rare.
I mean, Andrew, I agree with Andrew. I came up in a similar way. Maybe this happens to a lot of people. I remember even being in bands in like high school and early college, and they could never get them together. You know, could never stay together. And then I would have such a reverence for any band, no matter what they put out, just because like they've been together for 5 years. I'm like, my God, you know, I couldn't keep it together for a month. But I got to the point where people would ask me in terms of film, like, what do you like? You know, you can't, you know, and at some point, just hope and sort of all that kind of envelops around your criticism. And I think, like we were talking about earlier, you learn what kind of filmmaker you want to be through your criticism. You learn what you don't like, and you have a project and you have a mission. And, you know, by reacting to say, well, this is not what I'm interested in, and I know that, and you kind of refine your own sensibility. I mean, we had a really troubled shoot. You know, we had probably one of the most, you know, glorified troubled shoots there was. We had an insurmountable obstacle every day, the same one, and no one knew what to do. And it was insane. And so it's a miracle that any film gets made, but, you know, mine, it was actually a miracle that it got made. And it took support of a lot of people to all throw in their hats.
And you don't detect anything in watching the film, right, Andrew? I mean, when you're watching this film, you could not detect that there was a real, like, heavy duty. Like,
no, the only thing that came through, I was talking to the editor, David Barker, who cut here, and he's also a filmmaker as well. And, you know, he knew some of the sort of offset backstory shenanigans of our film. And, you know, I was mentioning that we knew it was a script that sort of dealt with this kind of constant pressure of poverty, and that there was sort of moments of darkness and sadness, but also moments of joy. But the film itself became much more sort of anxiety ridden on screen, intense. And his feeling is that there's always this sort of subconscious thing that gets across the screen. Like, it picks up on the energy going on around it. And I completely agree with that. And I think that's what happened, because we were like, yeah, we knew it was a sad film. We didn't think it would be as kind of tense an experience watching it. And I think that's definitely what happened with us. But I came up the same way. There was a while where I couldn't watch a film without just tearing it down. And now I really...
Another thing that springs to mind is I find that people... And I don't know how much this is related to what we're talking about, but I find that when people talk about when they see a movie, particularly people who aren't filmmakers, they see your movie and they'll talk about a decision that you made or something that happens in the movie, and the audiences seem to think everything was intentional. They're like, why did you do that? And you're, of course, as a filmmaker, you're always like, well, it had to be that way, you know, yeah, because we, you know, this happened, or we couldn't get that shot, or, you know, we had to switch locations at the last minute. And I remember, I don't want to get into it, but a friend of mine specifically asking me this, and I just wanted to tell him, like, listen, of course I wouldn't have done it that way had I had another option, but I couldn't. You know, making a film is, especially a very low-budget film, there's so many things you can't control.
Everything was on fire. That's why that way. It was like the Kurosawa thing where, like, somebody asked him about a shot in Ron, and he said, Well, you know, 2 feet to the right, you would have saw the Sony building, and 2 feet to the left, the Fuji factory, and that's right. why we framed it that way. But, and I mean, an independent film, it's like, okay, you have 3 minutes before this kid pumpkins and that thing happens, right. and this person's about to quit, and the camera's about to die on battery, so, like, just shoot the fucking thing. Shoot it. Go. Now. Go. You don't know the lines? Fuck it. Go. Yeah, I mean, you're running. You are running. We had 125-page script in 20 days, you know, and the whole time that schedule and that budget is a pressure. And we had more money than most. I mean, we had a healthy six-figure budget on ours, and it was still a nightmare. We still shot it on a Canon 5D, on a little DSLR, you know, even in that budget, because we flew in a lot of people, and, you know, there's not a lot of local crew, not a lot of independent film support in Vegas, and it was... We really brought a New York crew in to do it, and it was tough. But at the end of the day, there's a film. And you know, I was talking to Ira Sachs about some of the things we dealt with, and he had dealt with them similarly on some films. And his response was like, yeah, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You get a film. You know, there's so many stories of so many bad things that happen between takes and whatever else.
Yeah, it's... You know, you've probably heard this a million times before, but it's such a weird experience making a movie in that you live with it for years, mm-hmm. writing it, developing it, trying to get up and running, and it takes forever. And then there's this very brief, incredibly intense, pressure-packed series of a couple of weeks where everything is happening at this incredible rate and you're overwhelmed, and then after that's done, quiet. Then there's more years of trying to put it together and then getting it out there. And so everything hinges on these few weeks of just feverish activity. And it just doesn't seem fair.
I'm convinced there are better ways to make a film. I mean, there are big time directors who have it written in their contract that they work an 8-hour day or a 10-hour day. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the unions are fighting for a 14-hour day. Days are the most expensive thing. But I really do think, like, if you can't slow it down in some way, if you can't let your people, like, sleep a normal amount of time and work, you know, a rational kind of schedule, you're going to suffer. And there's got to be a more sane approach to making films. And I hope to, you know... On my next films, it's going to sort of be built into the thing. And mm-hmm. if we can't afford it, we're just going to cut it from other places, because you have to get your shots. If you're not there to do it, then what's the point?
I was just talking the other day to a filmmaker that I know and I very much admire, and who's just finished a feature. He was saying he scheduled 30 days for his movie.
So Joe Swanberg.
It's not Joe Swanberg. And okay, he's like, he's really happy with his movie. And he's like, the reason that this movie, I think, is good is because we did 30 days. He was like, I'm sure he would, if he did 15 days, I'm sure he still would have made a good movie, because he's really good. But he was just like, that was absolutely essential. I will never do it another way. Given enough time, you know, and I was just like aching with envy. It's like, that is so smart. If you could figure out a way to do it.
Well, yeah, I mean, days are the most expensive thing. I mean, the other thing I was going to say just about the travails of independent film in general, I mean, I've always made films since high school, since college, you know, couple, three, four features, couple of shorts, you know, music videos, whatever. But then I was in graduate school for fine arts for a while. I was doing conceptual art because film just sort of kept bankrupting me. I mean, I'm actually most known for a little doc, which is just a sort of a blowout fight with my wife about how much she hates film and all the money I've sunk into it.
Oh, wait a minute.
Called Film Makes Us Happy, which is online and played all over the place. And it's also hard to watch. Mm-hmm. But the funny thing about filmmakers as composed to like sort of my fine arts friends is, you so often have to talk about your work in the theoretical, right? You're so often, you even have to call yourself a filmmaker before you even, it's years before you get that opportunity. Before, how are you going to raise $500,000? I mean, a majority of the people working in independent film, there are many exceptions, but they generally don't work for a living. They have the time to act in other films, and they also have the resources to raise $100,000 or, you know, every year to make a little indie. And And for the, I mean, Andrew and I both have full time day jobs, and there are others out there. But you know, you find a way. It's going to delay you 10, 15 years from sort of the other model.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's funny. You have to have the kind of dedication to say, well, like, this is who I am as a filmmaker. I just may not have had that opportunity yet.
It is strange. Yeah, I've made, in 10 years, I've made 3 shorts and 1 feature, and I am a filmmaker, I guess. I mean, and you know, I actually think that's better than some.
Isn't it all about what you that you can hold it up and say, oh, I made these, and I'm proud of them, and I made what I wanted to make. I mean, well, kind
the strange
having
thing
made 6 films and that are kind of crappy or disposable.
There's something to be said about quality over quantity. I mean, I applaud people like Swanberg who can kick one out, you know, or 3 out every year. But often in watching those, I'm kind of looking forward to him slowing down.
Yeah.
And maybe putting more effort into sort of a script and things like that. I mean,
well, Drinking
just
Buddies.
Because you,
have
yeah,
you seen
Drinking
it?
Buddies, I think, is probably going to be a good example of that. Yeah. But just because you can make a film in 10 days for nothing doesn't mean, or maybe it means you should, but it doesn't mean I have to watch it necessarily. You know?
All right.
Although, honestly, you know, when I look back at the films I made, my quote-unquote meticulously crafted films, I'm not necessarily that amped about all of them. I mean, just because they took a while doesn't necessarily mean they're much better. Although Nancy Please is amazing, and you should all go
it's
see
very
it.
Very true.
And you can at the,
and you can
Rerun
at the
Rerun Theater starting May 24th. The other thing about that it comes to mind that drives me, that's so weird about making films, is that, like, I'm in this situation now where I started writing Nancy 4 years ago or something. And, you know, of course, it took a while to write the script. And then, of course, it took a while to get it produced. And then we shot it. It took a while to cut it and put it together. Now, when I watch it, now it's coming out in theaters. It's like looking back in time. It's like, oh, look, there were a lot of themes and ideas that I was really interested in 4 years ago. And you need to talk about it
it's new.
It just happened and it's coming up. But, you know, you're thinking, as much as I may have, you know, like the film and feel a great affection for it, it's really, you know, it's basically encapsulates my impulses and interests 3-4 years ago. And now I'm, you know, interested in doing other things. But everything you do in film, it just takes forever, and you have to live with it for good or for ill.
A significant part of your adult life.
Yeah. There was a director that was talking about looking at old films like visiting another country almost, and you're such a different person. I mean, on the same token, when I finished the script for About Sunny, my wife was like 8 months pregnant and my daughter is now 7 and a half. You know, that's when I finished the script.
Yeah.
So it's the same kind of thing. But I think film is great in the sense that, you know, I've done theater before and I've mounted plays, but you know, they kind of disappear.
Right.
And the great thing about film is that it is on film and it's captured and it's,
you have a finite
there.
Number of people that can see a play regardless of how large the theater is or how long the run is.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that feeling of like that I've moved on, like as an artist or as a filmmaker, and you see something, you're like, well, that was the best I could do 5 years ago, you know, given my sensibility, given whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think it keeps people working and it keeps people pushing.
I know I'm very much motivated by the idea. It's that I like my film, but ooh, the next one, I'm going to fucking hit it out of the park, and I just got to get an opportunity to do it, and it's going to blow minds, right, because, you know, you always want to top what came before, and you always think you can, because every time you make a movie, mm-hmm. you learn a tremendous amount in a very short period of time.
I've learned a lot talking to you guys. I'm going to wind it down just because...
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you.
No, pleasure. So I'm just going to recap for those listening that... Andrew Seaman's film, Nancy Please. It will be at the Rerun Theater, as we mentioned, on May 24th for a week-long theatrical engagement. You'll be there and maybe...
Yeah,
we'll
I certainly hope so. We'll we will have
just
cast there and hopefully other appealing things that in addition to the film.
My friends will come
out. Yeah, I'll be there to...
Brian will be there, I'm sure, if you're in town, right?
Yeah, you might be, as long as you...
No.
Okay. You're going out of town?
No. I've seen it.
Yeah, I know.
Now I'll be there. I'll support it.
You just come. You step in at the end. You know?
Rerun's great.
Yeah, we always have a good time. And Brian's film About Sunny, Nay, Think of Me,
That's right. Out now.
Out now on digital platforms.
On demand, iTunes, VOD.
So you can't, there's no reason. Moments from now when we stop, you can switch over and watch About Sunny.
And Nancy Bleeds will also be on VOD.
Right,
in
Factory
June.
25, we'll know more about that.
Just want to throw that in there.
No, very good. Glad you did. Guys, we'll be back. We'll come back in a couple of months and we'll do another thing.
Yeah.
That'll be great.
That will be great.
Thanks. Thank you, Brian and Andrew.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thanks, Adam.
Hello, Dan Nuxel.
How's it going, Adam Chartoff?
Oh, very well. Thank you.
Glad to hear it.
So you've had 2 weekends already.
We have, yeah. The Rooftop Films 17th Annual Summer Series has been up and running since May 10th.
It's in full swing. How were those events?
They've been great. We've somehow managed to dance between the raindrops so far. Mm-hmm. Things have been pretty good. Yeah, because it's been pretty cold and rainy in New York, but we've mostly dodged the rain and most of the cold, so that's mm-hmm. been good. We opened opening weekend May 10th and 11th. We started with our program short films, which was great. Mm-hmm. And then on Saturday, the 11th, we had the special sneak preview of Francis Ha, which is now also opened in theaters in New York City and mm-hmm. is doing great, which mm-hmm. is exciting to see. And those both went wonderfully. And then this past weekend, we had two really fantastic shows. One was Ruben Atlas's film Brothers Hypnotic, which was a free screening that we did at Metrotech Commons, which was fantastic. Hundreds and hundreds of people there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Was the crowd the Rooftop crowd, or was it the Metrotech crowd, or was it some sort of hybrid?
It was, it was a good mix of different crowds. The population of downtown Brooklyn is growing in terms of residents. There's a lot more residential spaces down there. So I think there's a lot more people from the neighborhood who found out about it, which is great. There's definitely, Rooftop Film fans who made it out just because mm-hmm. they were excited about the event. And of course, the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble, who were performing at the screening, and the documentary is, of course, about them, that also, they've got their built-in crowd as well. So it was really fun because they had a lot of friends and family there in addition to the fans.
Right.
So that movie's got a lot of, you've seen it, so that movie's got a lot of home movie footage from them growing up and stuff. And so that footage always is fun to watch with friends and family. Right. So it went great.
Their folks came?
Not their parents, but obviously the brothers are all in the band together, but all of their girlfriends and friends and all of that. If just their girlfriends come, it's a crowd. it was fantastic. It was really, really fun screening, and they killed it when they performed afterwards. They played for about 45 minutes after the screening, and they sounded amazing, and the audience was they were all very excited. So
were they dancing?
They were dancing.
That's nice.
Yeah.
And then you had one more night of shorts, right? On
yes,
we had our Saturday up at the Industry City. It was the first event at Industry City in Sunset Park. How'd that go?
It was indeed. It was great. It was a little chilly, mm-hmm. but otherwise fantastic. I'm sure it'll be warmer for our next show.
Did you sell any hoodies?
We sold a lot of hoodies, actually. Yeah. That's the one thing. When it's cold at a Rooftop Film show, the one thing that we know is we'll sell some sweatshirts. So.
Yeah, bring an ample supply.
That's why we never spend any money on heat lamps. Too. Our tote bags aren't bad either, but they don't provide too much warmth. that screening was great. It was a New York Mayhem short film program. So it was all films about catastrophes, all made by New York filmmaking teams. So it was great. We had a lot of the filmmakers out and a big party afterwards. And as you mentioned, it was our first screening at Industry City, which is a really, really cool spot. And I'm glad that our audience was excited about the venue as we were.
I remember we talked about it when you and Mark were on a couple weeks ago, and you mentioned the way it was going to work. That you're on two rooftops to mm-hmm. accommodate the crowd and everything, and or the limitations of how many people can be on a roof, mm-hmm. right? And then you're syncing, obviously, the screening, so on both roofs. So in a way, they could see each other experiencing the film as well as the backdrop of New York City skyline and all that.
Yep,
so
absolutely.
And it all sort of worked out.
It all worked. It worked. That's everything. Great. Everything functioned. So it was great. Definitely a little different from some of the ways we've done screenings in the past, but I think people really enjoyed it, and it's uh-huh. it's fun when you they can the people on the second roof can see and hear everything exactly the same as the people on the first roof.
There's at least two more. I know there's two more events at Industry.
Three more. Yeah. So we've got one pretty much every month. We've got one in June with Sundance Short Films, co-presentation with the Sundance Film Festival. And then in July, we've got a screening of Joanna Arno's film, I Hate Myself, Smiley Face.
Oh, yeah.
And then in August, we have our final screening there, which will be Todd Sklar's film, Awful Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Which is part of our South by Southwest weekend. So.
Mm-hmm. That everything's, you've pulled everything on, and you haven't gotten rained on. That's all. Maybe I shouldn't even say that.
We don't believe in jinx at rooftop films.
I know. You got to evolve past all that stuff. There's no room for superstition when you're doing outdoor events. It's just...
No, absolutely not. There's only preparation.
Yeah. So moving right along, though, this weekend, we're coming up to the Friday, the 24th of May, and Saturday, of course, the 25th. And there is on Friday night another short film block called Love Hurts at the Open Road Rooftop in the Lower East Side.
Mm-hmm.
And on Saturday, you have a...
Yep. So Friday is short films. It's sort of romance shorts, mm-hmm. little twisted collection of short films about love.
Unconventional.
Always unconventional. That's mm-hmm. how we keep it. And it's always a really popular program for us, and it's nice mm-hmm. to see people out on their dates, and then we get to mess with their heads with our twisted concept of romance. So that'll be a good one. And then on Saturday, Jordan Vaught Roberts will be in town with his feature film debut, mm-hmm. Kings of Summer, starring Nick Offerman and many other fantastic actors.
Yeah. And Nick from Parks and Recreation.
That's the one.
Yeah.
For those of you who watch television and stuff.
As well as Somebody Up There Likes Me. I think he was in that.
Yep. Very, very funny man. Mm-hmm. Funny once again in this latest one, which will also be coming out in theaters in a couple of weeks. So ours will be a sneak preview screening of it. It's a really fun film, really. Jordan will be there, and that's what we're excited about.
Oh, we are excited. Yeah. And Jordan will be on this show as well shortly, so eventually. Actually, both evenings are at the Open Road Rooftop. Let's also talk about the following weekend, since it's coming up so quickly.
Similar format in that our Friday night will be a short film program, our Trapped program, which is a twisted short about people caught in circumstances from which they cannot escape.
Like being in love.
Like being in love. Sometimes it's being in love. Being in love with the wrong person, perhaps.
Yeah.
That's a really fun, dark program. Also, a lot of twisted comedy and that sort of thing. Some great animation as well. So we're really excited about that program. And then the following night, we'll be showing Matt Johnson's feature film debut, The Dirties, which won several awards at the Slamdance Film Festival when it premiered. Mm-hmm. And we'll have the whole crew down there for this screening. So they're all coming down from Canada. Mm-hmm. So they'll be
They're from Toronto, right?
The whole batch are making their way down in some sort of Canadian minivan vehicle, I'm sure. They're a very fun, smart group of young men. So it'll be a good show.
That is. That's a good film.
You've seen it?
I have seen it, and I could tell about 10-15 minutes into it that they were from Toronto by subtle. No, by these subtle ways of saying certain words that I picked up on over
you pick
the
up
years.
The, you
with
pick
my
up
friends.
On the accents if you pay close attention.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting film, I think. Yeah, I'm curious to see how audiences react to it. It's definitely a dark twist on the gun violence story.
Yeah, right.
And I think it will probably perplex some people. It's a very entertaining film, it's got a lot of energy. It also comes from kind of a twisted young male perspective that I think
keeps everything the emerging from
we
this season.
We show some twisted stuff. That's what we
it's
do
true,
that a
it's
bit.
It's true. No.
That's kind of our thing a bit.
So. Well, it definitely is a catalyst for it's going to definitely act as a catalyst for conversation. That's for sure, because it's definitely worth seeing. Good. So we have a bunch of shorts coming up in the next two weekends, and we have The Kings of Summer and The Dirties. And it's all at one location, so it's easy just to...
Our screenings for the next couple of weeks are all at Open Road Rooftop on the Lower East Side. So.
$350,000.
Mm-hmm.
Tickets are now available on Rooftop Films' website, rooftopfilms.com.
They are indeed.
So get them now.
Events so far have sold out, so buy your tickets in advance.
Do. Great. Well, thanks, Dan.
Thank you very much, Adam.
That's the show. Thanks, everybody, especially Brian and Andrew and Dan Nuxel and everybody at Rooftop Films for helping make another episode of Film Wax Radio possible. Hey, guys, please write to me. Let me know what you think of the show. Send me your suggestions and feedback and comments to adam@filmwax.com. I'm eager to hear it, and I will get back to you. Go see Francis Ha in Cine Theaters right now. Noah Baumbach's new film. We talked to Noah and Greta just a couple of shows back. It's a very rewarding film. All right, guys, Adam Chartoff signing off with Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T. Till next week.